Words on Water.
Welcome to Words on Water, a podcast from the Water Environment Federation. This is the host, Travis Loop. Excited to be joined by two guests for today's episode. I'm with Gary Bellin. He's the Senior Director of Clean Water Supply Program at American Rivers. Gary, how are you doing?
Doing well, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Also joined by Janet Clements. She is the Senior Water Resource Economist for Corona Environmental Consulting. Janet, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Excellent. So we are going to talk about green infrastructure today, and we're going to talk specifically about some partnership work, some collaboration between the Water Environment Federation, American Rivers, and Corona. And this is really looking at the Great Lakes area and looking at green infrastructure financing and incentive-based solutions. So just for all our listeners out there, because they come from across the spectrum of water and from outside the water sector, who wants to take a crack at describing what green infrastructure is kind of setting the table for us here?
Sure, I can do that. So from our perspective, green infrastructure is any stormwater management technique or practice with the primary goal of preserving, restoring, or mimicking natural hydrology in a built area. Sometimes the term is used for larger scale conservation efforts, but we're specifically referring to smaller stormwater focused applications. And let me talk a little bit about why that's important. I grew up in a fairly rural part of the country and had my backyard stream, and it was really beautiful and vibrant, had lots of critters and living creatures. And when it rained, it generally didn't change its flow. It stayed pretty stable. And this is what I kind of saw as you know, your natural hydrology from a young age. We soon moved to a more urban area, and I still had a backyard stream, but this thing, when it rained, it just flooded. And when it didn't, it didn't have any water in it at all. And so there was no life, no living creatures. But on top of that, when it did flood, oftentimes in larger storms, it would flood backyards and flood out decks and property. And what I realized from that point on was, because there wasn't a natural hydrology involved, it was causing flooding problems. This natural stream was supposed to be a stormwater management device, but it wasn't working the way it was supposed to. And this sort of dichotomy between natural stormwater management and traditional stormwater management kind of inspired me to go into engineering and looking at these solutions. And it's really why I believe that green stormwater infrastructure, it's not the only solution, but I think it's an important component to our approach to stormwater management.
I think one of the keys that the three of us are aware of, and a lot of folks are aware of, is that, you know, green infrastructure, putting this in, it requires money, right? And it takes dedicated funding. How have municipalities really historically funded these types of projects? And what limitations have they faced in that funding area?
Well, traditionally, there have been a variety of different ways that they've used general funds, personal property taxes, wastewater revenues, parts of combined sewer funding programs, and so for some cities and a growing number of places, stormwater utilities. So it's kind of varied by location.
Janet, do you want to add something to that?
As Gary alluded to, there are a growing number of utilities that have a dedicated source of revenue through stormwater fees, right? So they're able to put a stormwater fee in place and collect money to manage stormwater. In a lot of states, there's legislation or certain rules that make it difficult to do that. And so a lot of utilities don't have that dedicated source of funding. And so there's competing priorities, right? So if you're a wastewater utility, kind of using your general funds to fund stormwater projects, you've got aging wastewater pipes that are competing for resources. That's also true if you're a municipality that's using kind of general funds or personal property taxes. There's always competing priorities. That's a well-known fact in the water world. So it can be difficult to kind of prioritize, especially green infrastructure projects. Mm. So that's why we're thinking about how to kind of creatively fund green infrastructure and think about different ways to finance it.
So I think one of the ways that some utilities, municipalities are looking for to ways to do this are market-based incentives, right? And this might be leveraging kind of resources from the private sector or other funders as a way to cost-effectively implement green infrastructure. So can you guys explain what that all means? What's the concept of a market-based incentive? What are some of the things that are happening out there?
Well, as I just alluded to, a lot of municipalities have difficult funding green infrastructure, and they're looking for more cost-effective ways to do so. What we're learning across a lot of municipalities is it's very cost-effective, a lot cheaper for utilities and municipalities to incentivize green infrastructure projects on private property. This is because, you know, if you're a utility and you're trying to go out into the public right of way and build a project, costs start adding up, right? There's lots of utilities within the public right of way. You have to coordinate across different departments. You have to get certain permits that may not be easy to get. In a lot of cases, it's a lot easier to leverage private sector resources and implement those projects on private land. And the way to do that is to think about how to incentivize private properties to implement private property owners to incentivize to implement green infrastructure.
What does incentivize a private property owner, you know, the private sector, to do something like that?
So there are probably six different types of incentive programs. So a lot of what we see across the country are things like rebate programs, where maybe you're providing a copay or a reimbursing property owners to incentivize to build rain gardens, for example. This provides them with a benefit of kind of an improved landscape. There are also grant programs, which fund typically larger projects, maybe on commercial industrial projects. It's a way to get kind of larger green infrastructure at scale. Again, property owners can benefit from landscape improvements, beautifying their property. And in many places, they can get a discount on their stormwater fee because they're managing stormwater on their property. Other ways to incentivize include incentives through the development process. So maybe you allow a property owner or developer to increase their floor area ratio if they incorporate green infrastructure on their site. There's also what we'll talk about a little bit more, some new innovative solutions like stormwater volume credit trading.
Interesting.
It's a way to help provide developers flexibility in meeting their stormwater standards.
Two of the cities in the U.S. That have really embraced green infrastructure and look to be very proactive in putting green infrastructure in: Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. And I think they've also implemented some creative ways to fund these projects, especially on private property. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the approaches that they're taking in Philadelphia and D.C.
Philadelphia, I'm sure many of our listeners know, is really one of the kind of the leading municipalities in implementing green stormwater infrastructure. So they have a comprehensive plan called Green City Clean Waters for meeting their consent decree obligations for reducing combined sewer overflows. As part of that program, the water department established a goal of implementing 10,000 what they call greened acres. And a greened acre just simply means that 10,000 impervious acres will be managed through green infrastructure or other kind of distributed stormwater management practices. Early on, I mean, think about 10,000 acres, right?
Yeah.
Early on, Philadelphia realized that, you know, they're going to need private property to meet this goal. So first, there's a lot of stormwater that's generated on private property. And second, as I kind of alluded to earlier, it's just a lot more cost effective for the utility to incentivize private property owners to do it, than to go out and try to start building these projects on their own. Philadelphia really has a whole suite of different incentive programs, and I'll just kind of talk about two here. One of which is early on in about 2011, I think, they implemented a parcel-based or impervious area-based stormwater fee. And then it's a relatively high fee compared to many fees throughout the country. And then they set up a program where property owners could receive a discount on their fee if they implemented stormwater management practices on site. So there was kind of an incentive built in, especially for large property owners that had a lot of impervious area, to, you know, manage stormwater on their site. And more recently, they implemented a grant program called the Greened Acre Retrofit Program. And the heart of this grant program is what we call project aggregation. And they're really, Philadelphia Water Department is really the pioneers of this. But what their grant program does, it's called the Greened Acre Retrofit Program. It is open or available to individuals or private sector consultants who go out, identify multiple projects, recruit property owners to allow them to build those projects on their land, and then bring all of those projects to the water department under a single grant application. Hmm. When they initially rolled the grant program out, I think the threshold was you have to bring us, you know, projects, 10 green acres worth of projects. Now that threshold's changed a bit over time, but the idea is that you're bringing a bunch of projects at once. So the water department would pay this, what we call a project aggregator, up to a set amount per green acre. The water department benefits because they're getting cheaper stormwater management practices, more cost effectively. They're benefiting you with the review, you know, a single grant application for multiple projects. The aggregator is benefiting because, you know, they get to, you know, realize a kind of modest fee or profit associated with the projects that they build. And then the property owner also benefits because they're able to take advantage of the stormwater fee discount that I described earlier. So it's kind of a win-win situation. So that's kind of the basics of the program. Now, giving credit to the water department, they kind of continue to reevaluate it over time and really make sure that they're providing the right level of incentive and that it's really functioning the way that they want it to.
Pretty much a leading municipality there doing some creative stuff. What about down 95, Gary, in DC? What are the approaches there to financing?
I've always found Washington DC's approach really fascinating, partly because I work here and so I've been able to see how it's started to take place and some of the results of it. But they're one of the first cities to really innovate using the whole idea of stormwater credit trading and using this the stormwater retention credit trading, I should say. And it started, they implemented this in 2014, and it was in response to the large amount of stormwater runoff they get into their combined sewer system. And so that's been a big driver. The first approach is they are building a deep tunnel system to control their CSO. But they realized that that's really expensive and it wasn't going to solve the entire problem, and particularly outside of the CSO area. And so when they were looking at the costs of this, they estimated that addressing the overflows with a deep tunnel would around 3.2 billion gallons annually by spending more than $2.6 billion on these capital solutions. But then when you look at the amount of water that was being shed in the non-CSO area, in the MS4 permit area, it was still a huge amount with water quality implications. And they figured it would cost over $7 billion to implement with green infrastructure retrofits.
Wow.
And that sounds like a huge amount, but when you're talking about the geographic area, which was much larger than the CSO area, it kind of makes sense. And they realized that they couldn't fund that by themselves alone. And so they wanted to take a more, how do you spread those costs around and utilize private market forces to help address that? What they did was they implemented in their permit a retention requirement about 1.2 inches, which is about standard here. And for land disturbing activity of 5,000 square feet or more, properties must retain that first 1.2 inch of rainfall on site. Now, what they did, though, was they also added some flexibility in it. Property owners had to retain the first 50% of the required stormwater retention volume on site, but then they could look to purchase credits to meeting the remaining 50%. So even if they could meet all the retention on site, they still had that option after that 50% was met, they could meet it with credits. And so those credits would be generated in a variety of different ways. The developer themselves could go above and beyond and generate their own credits to sell to other developers. They could pay in lieu to the city, and then the city had a set cost for that in lieu payment, and then they would go out and build green infrastructure on public property to build up more credits. And so that kind of set a ceiling for the price. So the amount of money that would cost for the District Department of Energy and Environment to build green infrastructure was much higher than the cost it would for the developer. So it set a ceiling, and so the developer could pay in lieu to do it, to have the city do it, but it was much more cost efficient for the developer to do it on site. The other ingenious thing that the city did was to set a bottom to this market, and they did that by guaranteeing a price that they would pay contractors that were building green infrastructure around in the city for these. And so that set a bottom price for the market. And so that really created this credit system amongst developers to incentivize both the use of green infrastructure on new and redevelopment, as well as generate a market for people to go create and sell these credits. It's really been fascinating to see since 2014 the effect that this has had on the city. As you see new buildings go up, almost every one of them has a green roof on it, for example. I'm seeing bioretention units popping up all over the place when the buildings are being renovated. And the other neat thing about this is it really helps utilize land use in a more efficient way. So downtown DC, land costs are much, much higher, and it's not as efficient to build green infrastructure on land down here. So this gives developers an option to build green infrastructure out in the suburbs, out of the CSO area, where it's more needed, and where land costs are cheaper, and particularly in low-cost or low-income neighborhoods, where land is much cheaper, there's more of an incentive to build green infrastructure there. So then you have a bit of an added benefit of beautifying communities in some cases as well.
I'm originally from the DC area, so I'm pretty familiar with the incredible things happening there. So that's great to hear more detail about it. So this brings us around to the collaboration between WEF and American Rivers and Corona. And I think what we're trying to do is advance these concepts and approaches for green infrastructure. And so we have the Great Lakes Protection Fund has supported this partnership and working to develop two different market-based incentives to create green stormwater infrastructure on both public and private property. Gary, can you explain a little bit more about this effort, this partnership that our three organizations are involved in?
So I think one of the things that has been seen in the stormwater community in general is that green infrastructure hasn't been implemented consistently throughout the country. You have some places that do a better job of it and other places that are having a harder time with it, or some places just aren't dealing with it at all. So the Great Lakes Protection Fund kind of sees themselves as an innovation funder. They're looking for that sort of next generation innovation to help us solve environmental problems, and they're very focused on the Great Lakes. And so they identified this problem in the Great Lakes of why some places were doing green infrastructure and why weren't others, and what could we do to really scale up the use of green infrastructure across the region. And so they tasked us with that job. They kind of saw this partnership-based approach to finding that type of scaling really appealing. So the strengths that WEF brought, American Rivers and Corona Environmental, they really like that partnership of bringing different perspectives and different strengths to try and find a solution to this intractable problem. As you'll see with our work, not so intractable, but it took a little bit of thinking and innovation. What we did was we first decided to find two pilot areas to apply different models and looking where they were working in some places. And so Washington, D.C. and Philly kind of served as these initial models, but they're really larger cities. So the question is, how do we apply these models to your more popular or populous mid-sized and smaller cities? And so we saw in the Great Lakes Grand Rapids and Cleveland. Now, they're still a little bit larger, but not as large. And they both had different perspectives that appealed to us. So in Grand Rapids, they didn't have a CSO. They pretty much solved their CSO problems. So they were doing green infrastructure for a variety of other different reasons, and were doing it through the MS4 process. In Cleveland, they have a CSO, and they also implemented a stormwater utility, which they're using. Whereas Grand Rapids, any city in Michigan, it's very difficult to set up a stormwater utility. So they wanted to find a different way of trying to fund these or incentivize these projects. So that's why those two cities were chosen for a variety of other different reasons and help us find two different options that would be reflective of many other cities across the Great Lakes and across the country. It's been really interesting to work on both of those. And so the concept in Grand Rapids is focused on the market-based incentive approach, whereas Cleveland has a robust grant program. And so there's a strong interest there about leveraging the strengths of community and foundation organizations, including community development corporations, to leverage this grant program and implement green stormwater infrastructure. With this sort of look at these different cities and how this could be scaled up, we formed something called Stormwater Currency, which is the branding of this joint project between WEF, American Rivers, and Corona Environmental, to build these solutions and sort of scale them up to other cities and start to work and partner with municipalities to identify the innovative funding or incentive-based programs that would work for them based on this initial research in these two pilots.
And I'm hoping that you could go into more detail about each of these two pilot areas. So Grand Rapids, Janet, what are the plans there?
In Grand Rapids, we are working with the city's Environmental Services Department to take a look at, evaluate the feasibility of, and design a credit trading program similar to the DC model. Grand Rapids will soon, they're expecting to receive their new MS4 permit in the near future. And it includes new retention standards for new and redevelopment sites. So how this plays out in Grand Rapids is that all sites that add 1,000 square feet or more of impervious area will need to retain or manage for the two-year 24-hour storm. And in Grand Rapids, that's equivalent to about 2.5 inches. So the retention requirement is new. Developers there are used to water quality and flood control standards, but this is kind of a whole new ballgame for them. Now, the permit, the MS4 permit that the city is expecting to receive, does allow for offsite compliance. So that really opens the door or the opportunity for credit trading. There are obviously some differences in, you know, between DC and Grand Rapids, right? So our challenge, as Gary kind of alluded to, is to think about how to design a program that's really going to fit the Grand Rapids context and really to figure out, you know, to see if it's going to work. So there's a lot of different kind of program design details that we're thinking about to make sure, you know, and evaluate whether there's enough supply in the market. Mm-hmm. So are people out there kind of generating green infrastructure projects? Gary talked about a couple sources of supply in DC and Grand Rapids. Credits can be generated by private property owners or contractors who go out and build green infrastructure on existing properties. So properties that aren't subject to stormwater management requirements. They can also supply the market. Developers can supply the market by going above and beyond their stormwater management requirements and kind of sell that excess capacity. And then on the demand side, you know, are there enough sites that are going to be subject to these stormwater management requirements that have an incentive to look to go offsite to meet them? In DC, and I'll just talk about some, highlight kind of a few of the differences between these two cities and how we're thinking about tailoring the market to better accommodate Grand Rapids. So in DC, one of the reasons that the market works is because in the downtown area, there's high land values, right? So much of the development is occurring in the downtown area, and developers would rather put that land area, I guess, to a higher and better use, build a bigger building or build a rooftop deck, rather than, you know, using it for stormwater management. So that in itself kind of provides an incentive for them to look to meet requirements offsite in areas where land is cheaper and more available. And in DC, this happens to be largely in the MS4 area where green infrastructure has a better, bigger impact, I guess, in terms of water quality. Now in Grand Rapids, we have a little bit of that same dynamic. So there is a downtown urban core. Land values are much higher in that area and land is less available. So that does provide some incentive off the bat for developers developing in that area to think about going offsite. In Grand Rapids, though, their MS4 permit puts some limitations on what development sites can go offsite. You know, in a market, ideally, you don't have those restrictions because you want demand to be as free as possible, right? You want anyone to be able to go offsite and purchase credits. So that the market kind of functions.
I know Grand Rapids is a great water city. I mean, they really have their eyes focused on clean and reliable water up there. So seems like a great market to be having this pilot. And I think the same thing could be said for Cleveland. You know, they've done incredible things, and now the 50 years since the Cuyahoga River was on fire in that iconic photo. So, what about Cleveland? What's the approach there?
So in Cleveland, we started off in a similar way as Grand Rapids. We looked for other municipalities that had used green stormwater infrastructure grant programs around the country to see what worked and what didn't. And actually, I really appreciated this approach because years back, I worked with the Milwaukee Municipal Sewage District with their green infrastructure grant program and had done some work there. And one of the grant programs give you a lot of flexibility. This is a sewage district or a municipality in terms of you can fund projects wherever you want, if you provide the money. The challenge is there's always a limit to the amount of money. So you can either fund some small, large projects, or you can fund a great deal of smaller projects. So there's some limits to what you can do with it. So what we were looking at was, how do you really leverage other sources of funding to support and scale up the grant funding that you do have available for green infrastructure? How do you get that bigger bang for the buck? In Cleveland, there's this sort of focus on areas of need for the district, focus on specific CSO areas where the deep tunnel won't necessarily solve all the issues. And then what we did when we found those focus areas, we went and talked with the neighborhoods and other relevant stakeholders in that area. And that includes community development corporations, regional and local foundations, neighborhood associations. And the goal there is to create a neighborhood green infrastructure investment plan. And what this does is it's identifying sort of the different focal points and I would say like golden opportunity areas for both the neighborhood and the sewage district. So this investment plan focuses on neighborhood opportunities such as playgrounds, schools, neighborhood green space that also match the geographies of need for the sewage district. It identifies community capacity needs to participate in the sewer district grant program. So how would they apply for the grants? Who would apply? How to incorporate this into other projects? And it would also identify investment opportunities, or rather identify projects with other funding resources in the neighborhood. So, for example, there might be other city agencies that are funding projects of some sort in that neighborhood that could leverage and utilize the grant program from the sewage district to allow a much larger project that would have benefits for the original funding city agency as well as the sewage district. So school funding, parks, for example, community investment. And so it was a way of identifying those areas that work for the community, work for the sewage district, and finding other funding sources to create a larger project with the smaller amount that the sewage district had put on the table. So the ultimate goal is that the sewage district gets larger areas of green infrastructure in target areas based on what they need for their CSO. And the benefit for the communities is additional funding for their priorities that help get projects implemented.
Do you really feel that what comes out of this can be models for other cities? I mean, I think that's probably your ultimate goal, right? Is like, hey, we've demonstrated what works and some approaches that can be taken in these size of cities, so other places can copy or pick off that menu of approaches.
Sure, and Janet, I want to add in here too. Stormwater, green stormwater infrastructure solutions. These are things that are being looked at by most communities at this point, not just in the two we're working on. And so that topic fits into the broader question most cities are grappling with around, say, affordability, equity, climate adaptation, value to ratepayers, and so on. So I think the general need is something that's applicable across the board. These two projects, I think, represent many mid-sized cities around the country. And as I said before, Grand Rapids is a non-CSO city. Cleveland is. Grand Rapids can't implement a stormwater utility. Cleveland does. So I think looking at both of these models are something that that any city can find a piece of there and successfully start to play around with and model for their particular community.
I definitely think it can be a model for other cities, you know, for many of the reasons Gary already alluded to. But I also recently, my colleagues and I recently finished a project for the Water Research Foundation. And part of that project, it was a fascinating project, and it gave us the ability to learn a lot about private property incentive programs. So what we did was surveyed and had in-depth interviews with utilities across the country about their stormwater private property incentive programs, what they've learned from them, we really try to dig into what did and what did not work. What were the failures and to try to bring those to light and how they fix them. And I was just amazed at the response from people on that project, just the level of interest from all levels of utilities, all sizes. And I think an important thing that we learned from that project was, you know, we often look to, like we talked about today, Philadelphia and DC, they're kind of the models, right? And I think there's a tendency to say, oh, but that's Philadelphia and DC. We can't do that. But I think it's important to recognize that they didn't turn into that overnight, right? Took a lot of work and they've been at it for a long time. And yeah, they have more funding, particularly because they're large cities and Philadelphia has a consent decree application and so does DC. You know, it's really just about starting where you are and thinking about your local conditions and what's going to work. Don't try to become those utilities overnight, but there are things you can do and grow from.
I think that's what's great about the stormwater currency program that we're trying to put together is it's really focused on helping different municipalities, different utilities take a look at themselves and start where they are with that sort of knowledge background that we can take from other cities and start to build and customize for those cities where they are and help them scale up just as others have done.
We at WEF look forward to working with you, continuing to work with you both and folks at American Rivers and Corona Environmental on this project and look forward to, you know, having some great outcomes and sharing it with folks in the months and years ahead. So thanks to you both for joining the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks, Travis. Really excited about moving forward.
Words on Water.